Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 327, I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Lisa Schockett, who is faculty at the University of Maryland. We discuss several topics, but we really spend some time talking about diabetic retinopathy, loss to follow-up, some of the challenges and some of the potential solutions that exist, and what we've learned from previous trials and what we can do in the future to kind of improve our understanding on compliance and disease adherence and treatment. As always, you can find a list of disclosures in the episode description. You can also find a link to claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is happy to be joined by Dr. Lisa Schockett. She is an associate professor for ophthalmology and vice chair for clinical affairs in the Department of Ophthalmology and Visual Sciences at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, where she also serves as chief of vitreoretinal surgery. Lisa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we like to start all of our interviews with new guests with the same kind of question to give our listeners some background. We have a lot of students who listen and people early in their career. So give us some perspective. Why did you decide to do ophthalmology and then why retina? Take us a little bit through your educational path.
Sure. So in medical school, I enjoyed all of the rotations, but to be honest, nothing particularly jumped out at me. So I thought and realized that the person I knew in my life who enjoyed their job more than anyone, whether it's medicine or any field, was my father. He was always so excited about ophthalmology and always so excited about retina. And he just, if you thought about what his hobby was, it was also retina. Like, he just thought it was fascinating. He liked to, you know, create things, invent things. And so I talked to him and he said, why don't you go over to the ophthalmology department? And I was at University of Pennsylvania at the time, so it was Shea. And I contacted Stuart Fine, who is probably one of the best mentors there is and always loved to teach medical students. And he put me in contact with Juan Grunwald. And I was able to do research projects and enjoyed that a lot and learned a lot about ophthalmology. And of course, they were both medical retina. So I easily became interested in ophthalmology and retina. And retina in particular, I think, is interesting because obviously we have like a lot of surgical and medical aspects, but it's not just one disease. We can, you know, diagnose syphilis or, you know, uveitis, CMV. Like, there's such a range of diseases that we see in ophthalmology and particularly in retina that you have access to all these systemic diseases, makes it more interesting.
Now, one of the biggest ones that you have interest in is diabetic retinopathy. There's a billion things people talk about with diabetic retinopathy, but one of the topics that's really come up, and especially in light of the pandemic, is access to care. And diabetic retinopathy, it's interesting because a lot of the retinal diseases you mentioned or we take care of, they're not necessarily tied to a chronic systemic disease and long-term sort of lack of control of that disease, right? So wet macular degeneration, for example, doesn't seem to have the same systemic associations. It may have some, but it's not really a systemic disease. Same thing for branch vein occlusions. But diabetic retinopathy, these are patients who don't just wake up one day with diabetic retinopathy. These are patients who've had a condition for a long time. So there's already a component when we see these patients that they have not, for whatever reason, been able to access the care that they need. And so it's interesting to start thinking, well, we enter their lives as retina providers or eye providers, that we aren't necessarily seeing them at the beginning of their process, even though it feels like that does. We're seeing them somewhere along the middle, and kind of tracking those patients over time can be challenging and giving them care. So give us, you know, I know it's an area of interest to you. Give us some of your perspectives on diabetic retinopathy and the challenges when it comes to follow-up for these patients.
Yeah, the statistics, I think, just to start, are just incredibly overwhelming in the United States. Like, the exponential growth of diabetes is really beyond imagination. So if you look back in the 80s, there were less than 6 million Americans who were diagnosed with diabetes. And then now there are 34 million Americans with diabetes. And projections say that by 2034, there are going to be 44 million Americans with diabetes. And that's the numbers, but 20% of those patients don't even know that they have diabetes. And then apparently the statistics show us that 88 million are pre-diabetic. So all those people have a huge likelihood of developing diabetes. And in Maryland, and I'm sure across the United States, there's a ton done to try to, you know, help with lifestyle and diet and compliance and adherence to treatments that maybe us as ophthalmologists aren't as involved in. And that's not our primary focus. But our primary focus is to get those patients into the door to get their annual eye exam. And then the second focus is how can we get them to adhere to the treatment that we suggest?
Yeah. There's been some studies looking at this, like you said, and the statistics are really staggering. In terms of pathways to improve this, people have kind of proposed different options. From your perspective, what do you think are the, I mean, there, it's a systemic issue, in, right? Not just diabetes, but diabetic diabetes in terms of the U.S. healthcare system, the world healthcare system. But like, what do you see as kind of ways forward that we can help patients follow up better with us, that it's not just, oh, okay, this patient didn't show, cross them off your list, move on. Like as a field, what can we do to kind of improve this? A lot of people have commented on it, but I don't think anyone has shown, there's never been like a quality improvement study I've seen, which has been like, oh, our diabetic retinopathy follow-up rate was this before, and now it's this.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think we've done a lot to try. If you look at the literature, we've tried to improve follow-up, we've tried to improve annual exams. I think the DRCR Network's Protocol M is interesting because they're trying to improve hemoglobin A1C by teaching, but we didn't really teach the patients in that study, it seems to me. I didn't participate in the study, but it seems to me like we were just giving literature or reading pre-printed literature to patients, but we weren't really interacting appropriately. If you're asking what I think would work, obviously I don't know, but I am impressed by a study that was done by Julia Haller in 2015. And I think the direction she was going is the right direction, which is she engaged community healthcare workers in Philadelphia. And she had two groups of people. One group, the control group, had a community healthcare worker that just spoke to the patient and just listened. And the other one said, what are your barriers to care? What do you think is preventing you from going to your annual dilated exam? And they addressed those barriers. They made the appointments. They said, oh, you know, you don't know how to get there. Here's the, you know, take bus 13 or whatever it is. So they helped to decrease those barriers to care. So it's very one-on-one and interesting also, they racially match the community healthcare workers to the patients. And I think that goes to what I experience daily is this extreme mistrust of providers. And interestingly, I have this fabulous photographer who's been with University of Maryland for a long time. And he is, he'd be upset if I said this, but he's a older African-American, very kind guy who I've known since I was 10, actually. And he sometimes I can tell that a patient isn't going to come back. I'm going to say, oh, you need, you know, all this laser or you need injections. And they just look at me and they're not going to comply with treatment. And then I go in the other room and I grab Ricky and I say, Ricky, can you show the patient the pictures and can you talk to them? And then they come out and they said, okay, I'll do the laser.
Interesting.
Because they trust him more than me.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, that speaks to other issues we've talked about before is, you know, having a wide range of people in our field, right? Because we all connect differently to different patients and they are looking for different things in their providers. You know, the other thing I think that would be interesting, and it's just coming to mind, is you referenced Protocol M. Protocol M was kind of pre-digital information, pre-kind of how people consume information today, which is primarily, for better or for worse, social media and Google and, you know, Medscape and all these websites that patients can just go access. I don't think I would be, we did a study recently looking at ER patients and what percentage of them Googled their symptoms before they came in. And no surprise, like the vast majority of them, right? Like I think most of us who have access, and there may be a handful of our patients who are just really in such bad circumstances, they don't have access to anything like a phone or a computer, but most patients have access to something today in the United States. Most of them are going to if they have any sort of health system, that symptom, that's like the first thing you do after you call your loved one is like, you look it up. And I think even doctors who have medical issues are guilty of this. And it'd be interesting to see, like we saw with COVID, a lot of misinformation, for example, about and mistrust about vaccination and medication options and like, how is this masking and all these things. And a lot of the ways that the CDC and the government and Surgeon General and people tried to combat misinformation, they actually said, okay, we're going to roll up our sleeves and go where people want their information to be. We're going to go and release videos on Instagram and on TikTok, and we're going to go and go on Twitter and tweet out at the world. And we're going to go on Facebook. And I just wonder, maybe for our diabetic patients, at least the ones who have vision, right, who hopefully is most of them, the ones who are earlier in their process who are using these devices, I wonder if a repeat of Protocol M with more of a digital approach would make more sense. Just because maybe that's where things are going. Diabetics tend to be younger patients than our other patients to begin with. Like I don't think an AMD study would work still with those devices, but maybe the diabetic, especially because they're getting younger and younger as it's basically its own epidemic in the United States and the world. I wonder if that's one of our barriers, is just how we give that information. Because it sounds like Protocol M was like, everyone looks at Protocol M, they say, well, it was really depressing because it didn't work. But as you're talking about now, like if you actually were on the front lines, like looking at how Protocol M was done, it wasn't necessarily, it was kind of clunky and I'm not criticizing the people who designed it, but I think that it was just one of those things where it was designed and the way it was executed didn't end up kind of panning out the way you would like it to be.
Well, I feel like the protocol wasn't as conversational. It was more, you know, reading information and not trying to understand what the patient was perceiving. So it needed to be more of a conversation with the patient to try and understand how they felt about their disease and how they were understanding their need for treatment. So at least once a week, I see a patient who comes in inner city Baltimore, typically African-American, young female, somewhere like in their 20s, 30s, who has recently lost vision in one eye. And you can see like PDR everywhere in the periphery, traction, NVE, and you know that second eye is going to go. And I try so hard to communicate with that patient and tell them if we don't do anything, the other eye will go. And you would think after losing vision in one eye, that that would be impressionable, that that would show them that they need to comply with treatment, but it doesn't motivate people. In Maryland, you know that there's a certification around the country for community healthcare workers, but in Maryland, I'm currently working with the Maryland Department of Health to make a subspecialty for diabetes. And I think it's important. There's obviously endocrinologists and pharmacists on the panel advising the curriculum, but I think it's so important to have a retina specialist on these curriculums because we don't want an annual eye exam as just like a checkbox. I got my annual eye exam, or I sent my patient for an annual eye exam. I think they have to realize it's so much more, you know, that you can't just go for your annual eye exam and get it checked off. There's a lot of treatment involved. And in order to preserve your vision, you need to do a lot. And I don't think that that's communicated appropriately without retina specialists involved in these curricula.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think that, part of this is not an excuse, but part of it is, it's part of kind of a cultural issue, not just with retina, but maybe the whole healthcare system is so much of our focus is focused on treatment than prevention, right? So like, I hate to say that the tail should wag the dog, but I just wonder if, you know, if there was more sort of financial incentive placed on practices and institutions to spend time on counseling and prevention when it came to diabetic retinopathy, then I think you would start to see a movement away from right now. It's just like in retina, it's like, you know, pump, pump, pump. It's very quick. And our clinics are very busy, and we have probably have more patients than we can see sometimes. And it doesn't necessarily lend itself to deep, meaningful conversations about diabetic retinopathy with these patients. And again, it's very different than, you know, your AMD population. I think they're really the classic comparison because they're the two conditions we do the most injections for, right? But AMD, yeah, you should counsel them as easy to talk about. But, you know, for the most part, once they're on an injection schedule, most of those patients kind of just understand that, you know, what I need to do is come and get my injections, and maybe I'm taking Preservision and I'm not smoking. But it's not as complicated as a diabetic patient who, you know, just because they have good sugar control doesn't mean that they will stop needing injections. Just because they don't have good sugar control doesn't mean they progress slower than someone else. We don't trends, but it's not like a one-to-one correlation there. And it's a little different. You know, I feel like AMD, the injections are fighting 94% of the battle. And then the other things the patient does at home they're important, but they're a smaller component versus diabetic. It's probably the opposite. It's probably in terms of their overall disease process and health. It's like 90 to 95% of the battle is being fought at home or away from the office. And the injections are great, and they obviously can modify disease severity and diabetic macular edema, but they're not curative and they're not fixing all of the issues. And I think maybe that's why as a field, we're just not used to that. Maybe the only people in our field who are kind of used to that are uveitis colleagues, you know, who are managing systemic immunosuppression. But even then, the medications are doing a lot of the work. It's not really like a lifestyle modification component that is really at play. So I mean, there's probably other examples in our field that are less common, like hypertension or, you know, hypertensive retinopathy, but we don't really have a comparison for something that's so dependent in our field, at least, what the patient does at home.
That's definitely true. I feel because of those issues, I'm a big proponent of laser and PRP, because I feel like if a patient comes in with PDR and I've done this before with these young women, I'll do 1200 spots of PRP in both eyes in one sitting, because I might not see them again for 15 months. And then they come, I just saw someone yesterday like this who I remember feeling like I'm being so aggressive and this is so much for this young girl to sit through, but she's gonna have her vision in the long term. And she has really good PRP now. You know, she has a ton of ischemia and poor perfusion in her macula, but she has vision. And the PDR is not progressing, but if I had just done injections, and she didn't come back for her 15 months, then she'd have a TRD.
Yeah. People who listen to this podcast know that that's like, I think that most people in our field, I think they've done PAT surveys now, that most people in our field are not using anti-VEGF at this point for primary modification of retinopathy for that very reason. And I think the pandemic taught us, we had patients who disappeared. We've all had examples of patients who, you know, I've seen patients years ago at our institute who had PRP in one eye and then disappeared, never came back. And they come back and that eye looks great. And the other eye is a total train wreck. And, you know, the hard part with PRP is like, you know, it's not without side effects. I think thankfully, again, this kind of goes back, unfortunately, the opposite side of like patients not fully understanding. I don't know if, as a field, we do a good job of talking to patients about the downsides of PRP. It's probably better in some ways because the pros outweigh the cons. But I'm curious, like, how do you approach that conversation? Like, if a patient is like, you know, I've read about this procedure and it reduces my peripheral vision and it affects my night vision and things like that. I can give you my spiel, but how do you kind of approach that conversation with the patient who brings those issues up?
Most patients not their primary focus, but I have had that conversation and I tell them that that in protocol S, patients with ischemia lost peripheral vision just because of non-perfusion. So the disease process is affecting the peripheral visual field either way. And this is going to preserve their vision in the long term. And I explain, you know, other things are going to happen in in diabetes. You might be in the hospital for a foot infection, and we don't have to worry because your laser tucked your retina in, you're safe, and we'll see you when you get out of the hospital. Whereas if you're dependent on your monthly injections and you miss them, a lot can change.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and I think that it's interesting. Like, I always think it's interesting when people bring up, I mean, sometimes you hear people in meetings here argue about the downsides of PRP, but the protocol S data is pretty fascinating when you talk about the peripheral field loss over time. And that's like a question I get from residents all the time, which we don't have great studies on, except for protocol S, is like, well, if all that retina is non-perfused, how functional is it? Like how functional is that retina? And I think it is functional because the baseline fields in those patients, we don't have like correlation to wide field FA, but it wasn't like those baseline fields were super constricted in those patients going into the study, but maybe it's on its way out, right? And that's why you see the drop in visual field over time, is that retina's hanging on by a thread in terms of functionality and risk benefit wise, if it's heading that way anyway, like that's where it makes sense to do the laser. I mean, I have residents all the time who are just like, I don't get, there's no capillaries, you know, beyond a disc diameter from the arcades. How would this patient even notice peripheral field loss? I think it just shows the tenacity of that peripheral retina to give you some peripheral vision.
I can't say I've ever had a patient tell me after PRP that they've noted peripheral visual field loss. I've never had a patient complain to me about that, even though I do aggressive laser.
I've had a couple here or there, but I would agree, like in the vast, if you like put all those, I think for both of us, it's a lot of patients who've needed PRP, unfortunately. Like, it's like, it's got to be like 1% or less anecdotally that have talked about it. But before we break, and you've been great, you know, I'm just curious, you know, I always like to ask academicians, we have a lot of people who listen to the podcast who are residents or fellows or are kind of working their way up in their career. But they're always interested in like kind of career planning and how do I kind of design? And we get a lot of people like, you know, I want to do academics. But when it really comes down to it and they go academic, they're like, well, I knew I wanted to do this because I like this environment or I like the education or I looked up to my mentors, but now I'm here and what do I do next? Right? Like I went from residency. I wanted to go to fellowship. I went from fellowship. I wanted to get a job. And now I'm in this job. How do I kind of decide what I want to do? It's kind of the first time in your career as a doctor that you have a lot of liberty in terms of what you choose to develop. And no one's really on you telling you need to do this or this, hopefully in a good department. So like, what kind of advice just before we break, would you give somebody who's in that position and kind of deciding how to prioritize different things?
I think there are two important things here. One is that you want to find a place when you're looking for that job where you feel comfortable at the institution. I am extremely lucky where I'm in a department where all of us get along so well and we can collaborate well together, no matter what it is, whether it's like a complex patient who came from shock trauma or one of these complex diabetics who needs several services. Like, we work so well together. So that allows you to collaborate and provide the best care to patients. And it allows you to collaborate on research projects. And I've never been in a department that is so easy going like that. So I think that's a gem, and it comes from the chairman. You know, that's the milieu, the feeling that he wants in our department, and that's what we see. That's the first thing. And then in day to day, what patients you're seeing, what makes you most interested? For me, this topic of diabetes and non-adherence is really interesting to me. Because I feel like if we make a change, if we can figure it out how to make a change in adherence to care, that would make a difference in the world. That would, you know, that would make a difference in diabetes in the United States. That would be fabulous. We could improve on blindness in this country. So if there's something that you're passionate about, that's obviously easier to research and get engaged in. So those are the two things, like find colleagues that you want to work with, and then two, find something you're interested in.
Terrific advice. Well, Lisa Shaka, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure our listeners will appreciate those insights, and looking forward to seeing you hopefully in person the next year.
Thank you. Enjoy the weather in Miami.
Many thanks to Dr. Shockett for joining us for this episode. Listeners, remember you can find all 327 of our episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's retinapodcast.com. They are easily searchable and available for your review. Remember that you have the access to us on social media, on Twitter and on Facebook at Retina Podcast. And you can contact us in many ways. You can reach us by emailing us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. You can click on the Contact Us link on our website. You can also reach out via social media, and you can get updates on the most recent episodes either by subscribing on our website, that will get you email updates in your inbox, or by going to your favorite podcast app on your phone. Let us know if you don't see it in your podcast app. We've tried to be in all the major ones, but we're in Amazon now as well, so you should be able to find us and get subscribed so every week you get the latest episodes. Thanks again to Dr. Venikasa, Kai, and Chang for putting together this episode. Thank you, listeners, for the articles you read and publish, everything you do on a daily basis to take care of patients, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreather, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.